any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Love the Beatles, love the Beatles. I had shows where I would play Beatles at the beginning, at the end, sometimes even in the middle. Well, I'm going to give you an update on some of the stories out there, but the biggest ones have to do with vaccine mandates, where I have a fabulous guest who will join us at the bottom of the hour to talk about the Fifth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit and what it all means. Meanwhile, we have Joe Manchin dropping a Christmas bomb on the Democrats. He will not support Biden's Build Back Better Act. This is a wonderful development, in my opinion. This Build Back Better has just horrific elements to it. It was going to, and I think this is a pursuit of equity, that the Democrats think everyone should be paid the same for every job they perform, no matter how menial, so that a janitor should make as much as an executive of a corporation. I believe this is driving them because they have changes there that I now believe are going nowhere, that would drive up the cost of child care for families, $27,000 more a year to give better wages to those who are conducting child care. There's something like maybe as many as 50,000 new electric charging stations that are going to be all over the place, and others, they're going to use a staggering bill to reshape America, to get rid of the coal and oil industry, which is going to turn us into a third world nation based upon beliefs in the mythical global warming. I've had enough conversations with Joe Olson to be convinced that the global warming phenomenon is a myth. It's mythology. A CO2 actually is indispensable to our health. It's not a global hazard. I always thought there was something odd about it, but it was a bit vague in my mind. Turns out that, of course, CO2 is indispensable to life because trees and bushes convert it into oxygen, which we need to breathe in order to survive as a species. Turns out that CO2 cools the earth in four different dimensions. And when they start talking about methane and cow farts, I mean, it reaches the point of absurdity, where the Great Reset, I think, has the plan in mind that they're going to do away with meat, that is, except for the global elites, of course, and we're all going to be eating insects. They'll be, you know, ground up like soy into something that's supposed to taste like a burger. But I'm telling you, what they have in mind for the future is about as disgusting as it gets. More about Joe Manchin, whom I now promote to my pantheon of American heroes for 2021. He may be the single most important figure this year in terms of politics. In fact, I think it's pretty unqualified. The West Virginia Democrat confirmed in an interview on Fox News Sunday yesterday he will not, cannot vote for Biden's Build Back Better plan. Not only will he not support the massive $1.75 trillion legislative package, but he will not continue negotiations moving forward, officially killing the bill. I've always said this. if I can't go home and explain it to the people of West Virginia, I can't vote for it. I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there. Meanwhile, Marjorie Taylor Greene is calling out the Democrats as communists right in Congress. I mean, I am infatuated with her. I think she's absolutely wonderful and sensational. And I think that this equity thing is confirmation. I mean, that's a communist ideal. Everyone being equal, regardless of ability, regardless of accomplishment, regardless of contribution, everyone's supposed to be treated the same. I mean, we're talking about an homogenized society. We're talking about the antithesis of capitalism, where you're rewarded for your accomplishments, your ingenuity, and your creativity. They want to stifle all of that. Stamp it out. It's like in the educational arena, getting rid of D grades and F grades, which is moving forward apace. In Oregon, you know, no longer requiring the ability to read, to write, or do basic mathematics as a graduation requirement from high school. This is all moving the country to the lowest common denominator, and I think that's what the Democrats are all about. It is disgusting beyond belief. What else did Manchin say? He released a lengthy statement explaining why he refuses to support the BBB plan. Notably, he sharply criticized the Democrats' vision for America. My Democratic colleagues in Washington are determined to dramatically reshape our society in a way that leaves our country even more vulnerable to the threats we face. I cannot take that risk with a staggering debt of more than $29 trillion and inflation taxes that are real and harmful to every hardworking American at the gasoline pump, grocery store, and utility bills with no end in sight. He said the Democrats are being honest about the true cost of Build Back Better plan. There's no doubt about it. The Nonpartisan Budget Office, Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, determine the actual cost is upward of $4.5 trillion, more than double what the bill's supporters have claimed. They continue to camouflage the real cost of the intent behind this bill, Manchin has observed. And the deal is, they're pretending as though all the programs they're introducing would expire after a year. But look, that's ridiculous. They're not introducing a program that's going to expire after a year. That's a budgetary gimmick. It just reflects how dishonest are these Democrat politicians in Washington, D.C. He also said the bill would hinder America's ability to respond to increasing geopolitical threats from Washington, China, risk the reliability of our electric grid, increase our dependence on foreign supply chains. I will never forget the warning from then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, that he delivered during a Senate Armed Service Committee hearing during my first year in the Senate. He testified that the greatest threat facing our nation was our national debt. And since that time, our debt has doubled. I'd observe, by the way, that a further contribution to the destroying the national security of the United States is Biden's act when he first came into office, by immediately canceling the XL pipeline and doing everything else to make us no longer energy independent. I'm not in favor of everything Trump did during his tenure. And there may be some aspects about the warp speed vax thing that are particularly troubling, but he made us energy independent. He gave us a robust economy. The lowest earning wage earners were finding their wages rising at the highest rate. He clamped down on the border. He was solving problems. This guy, this administration, whoever the hell they are, and believe me, there are lots of good questions here about who in the world this guy is that they trot out as a president, because I guarantee you 100% it's not. The real Joe Biden, this is not the senator from Delaware. This is a body double. I've gone into this in great detail on many occasions. They not only have different colored eyes, different ears, they have different shapes of skull. Now, let me ask you this. How can somebody change the shape of their skull? The answer is they cannot, and they are not the same. And if they have different shapes of skull, they're obviously not the same person. They have different signatures. Your signature, though it may change over time, they tend to be highly reliable, very distinctive. And we have two very different signatures from the real Joe and the guy who's in office now, as was observed by a pharmacist used to comparing signatures to make sure prescriptions were not being illegally obtained. So we're living in a farcical world. They even have a set. They've got a made-up set in the executive office building of the Oval Office, which has an auditorium. So you got the reporter sitting right there. They know the whole thing's on a soundstage, and yet they don't report it to the American people. How phony is that? Meanwhile, we have in a state of delusion about the Biden presidency. As more and more Americans struggle from its ruinous policies, growing members of the Democrat Party continues to show how disconnected they are from the country, really from reality. Several weeks ago, Hillary criticized Americans for not being thankful to Joe Biden, saying persons across the nation ought to be grateful for his job in the White House. How can anyone say that? I mean, she can't be paying attention. She received immediate backlash for being astoundingly aloof to the negative nationwide impact of the Biden administration on America. Hillary, however, is far from the only Democrat. House Speaker Pelosi, Biden, similarly, is being called out for having an out-of-touch, tone-deaf take on the job Biden's doing as president. During a celebratory Democratic National Committee event, she went overboard singing the praises of our 46th president. According to the speaker, he's a great president, and America is supposedly blessed to have him in office. She continued, declaring that people of the United States can relax now that Biden's in office, then described the 46th president as having hands that are both experienced and capable of leading. She also praised Kamala Harris, saying the country was blessed to have her as a partner to the president. This is just incredibly stupid. Some reports suggest Biden actually wants to install a different vice president. And I think there is a problem, given that Biden is so clearly demented and incompetent. If they take out Biden, they move up Harris, who has even worse poll numbers. Biden's down to 36. Harris is down to 28. My God, they're almost approaching the level of contempt that the public has for Congress. In light of the multitude of problems facing the nation, there was mixed feedback for Pelosi's assessment. Many branded her as out of touch and delusional for making such outrageous remarks that fly in the face of reality. I would second that. Pelosi doesn't go so great.
Looks like we had some technical difficulties here on B with Jim. Give me a second. I'll get Jim right back. Maybe his system crashed. I'm not 100% sure. Okay, where'd Jim go? Let's see. Yeah, I know Jim went. Jim went bye bye. Hey Jim, I hope you're out there. He's probably rebooting his computer at this time. He'll be able to join us back here in a minute. Yeah. Anyway, so okay. So they hear Mitchell. Okay. All right. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I don't know if you hear the, do you hear the TV banging behind the, do you hear audio background noise on me right now? I'm just checking because I don't know how canceling, well, this cancels out this other sound in here. Hey, here's one for you. Donald Trump has sued Attorney General Lieta James, arguing that his constitutional rights has been violated by the more than 2-year investigation into his family and their real estate business. Her mission is solely guided by political animus and a desire to harass, intimidate, retaliate against a private citizen who she views as a political opponent. The suit read, hey, here we got a dink. Maybe that's Jim. Jim ready to come back yet? I'm not sure. Let me try to ring Jim again and see if we can't get Jim back with us. He might be having some internet problems. We've been having some internet outages here and there. Jim's unavailable at the time, right now. According to his Skype is unavailable, which means he's probably rebooting, restarting, or attempting to. thank you everybody there that let me know that Jim went gone. Let's get back over here to the chat room. Yeah, okay, they can hear the background. To mute it for a second. Let's see, where's Jim? He could call back if he's listening. He can call back on a cell phone if he has to. This is some of the things that happened here on Revolution Radio. Donald Trump evidently filed suit today against Lieta James, who is her politically weaponized attorney general suit. Bump, ba-dump, bump. Yep. So, of course, they've been harassing Trump, and it is political warfare. You know, we have to understand that James Comey, Andy McCabe, Pete Strzok, Lisa Page, you know, ran a political PSYOP, a counterintelligence political operation against a presidential campaign. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a problem with government, isn't it? Yes, it absolutely is. So government ran a weaponized political assassination against the president of the United States, while his opponent, Hillary Clinton, ladies and gentlemen, paid foreign nationals to knowingly lie and interfere the election of the United States and the president of the United States of America, the Brookings Institute, and was also involved with Fiona Hill, Dan Shenko, Charles Dolan. Is that his last name? Heck, I don't remember. I'll talk about it tomorrow night, 8 to 10 p.m. on the Trump Assassination Files. So if you're available, if you're around tomorrow night, 8 to 10 p.m., I'll name the names. I'm not afraid to say who I believe was involved in the political assassination of Donald J. Trump. Yeah, I mean, what do you mean? Our government did it. We know they did it. We know they lied and attacked Trump and his campaign. Yes, there is no doubt. Let's see. Maybe we go up here. We'll try to get a hold of Jim again and try Jim's number again. If not, I'm going to try his cell phone if I have to. Anyway, so, yeah. Don't forget, there's also a lot of power issues everywhere. Yep, Jim's still not available on this line. So maybe I should ring his cell phone. at least to find out what's going on. And, gosh, here, I'll be right back. Let me call. Hey, okay, it's Mitch back here on Studio B. Let me see if Jim is, it almost like his power's down and out there where he's at right now. And call so we can get him back up on back here on the air. I honestly don't know if he even knows he got bumped off. But it says unavailable right now for Jim. So that's strange. I tried to sell his home phone number. I didn't get any answer. So that's, or I should say his cell. I don't know if I have his home phone number here, his landline here with me to up here in Ohio. Yeah. That's, hey, welcome to live production, right? I'm sorry, everybody. Yeah, Jim does have a landline. I've got the number here somewhere. I got a cell phone, too. I just tried a cell phone just to tell everybody I didn't get it. James. Should I do what? Hey, May, I see that over there in the chat room. That's kind of funny. Jim. Evidently, he's not on Skype. His Skype's not picking up at all. It's deader than a doornail. And maybe we'll try a cell phone. Okay, this time. Let's try Jim's cell phone. See if he'll pick up. I mean, I don't know what could have happened out there. Maybe they just had a tornado. Maybe the power went out. Maybe they took out the line down the street from Jim's house.
Hey, this is Jim Fetzer. Please leave a message and I'll get back at my earliest opportunity. Thank you.
At the tone, please record your message. Finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Everybody,
to leave a callback number, press 5.
Hey, Jim, this is Mitch and the station calling you back. Hey, we're here on the show waiting to get a hold of you. And your computer went down or your line went down, but we don't have you on the show, okay? Just wanted to call you and tell you. Give us a call back on Skype, please. Yeah, so anyway, I removed Jim's cell phone. I just have to make sure when I go back I add Jim's cell phone. Yeah, gosh, I hope everything's going to be okay. We're going to break here in a minute, and then we'll have our guests come in. Pfizer whistleblower come in while we wait for Jim to come back from wherever he went. All right, we'll talk to you then after the break.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hey, everybody, this is Mitch coming back in. This is the raw deal. James Fetzer has dropped off the air, and I can't get a hold of Jim right now. Hello, Deanna.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, this is the raw deal. My name is Mitch. I'm the I'm Jim's producer. And hi. I don't know if Jim is having technical problems on his end, but he was broadcasting, and then all of a sudden, it's like he went dark.
Oh.
And I don't, you know, we cover a lot of topics of interest here, and of course, including yours, with yourself being a Pfizer whistleblower. Can you get? I'm not real familiar with your whistleblowing. Is it possible that you can give us some background so everybody out here on Revolution Radio, we are streaming live. We're going out here in Studio B, so everybody can understand your background, your expertise, your knowledge, and what you really know about this COVID craziness.
Sure. I have two law degrees from USC and Berkeley, and I have been a law professor for 20 years, from 2000 to 2020, and I taught constitutional law, I taught First Amendment law, I taught tort law, and other areas of law. But I specialized in my scholarship on the Liberty Clause to a large degree, particularly as it relates to children's rights not to be spanked, and to people's rights to avoid medical procedures or to obtain medical procedures like an abortion. So I have recently written an article about the Liberty Clause as it relates to medical liberty, what I call, and that'll be coming out in the Florida State University Law Review as the lead article in April of 2022. And I discuss in detail what the court has done for over a century in terms of protecting us from medical procedures we don't want. And basically, my argument is that other than the right to life itself, which cannot be taken without a lot of procedure, if you're going to subject someone to capital punishment, they are entitled to an enormous amount of procedure. But the next right that I find to be the most fiercely protected is the right against medical invasion into the body. And the court has said on numerous occasions that that is just, you own your body. That is the one thing that the government just can't do. I mean, it's fascist to tell someone you must take a medication and that sort of thing. Now, there's one big glaring exception, that's school vaccinations. And that's why I went through all of the cases from the 1800s all the way to 2020 in the article coming out. Every single vaccine case that's in the appellate courts, I discuss and I dissect them and I explain why they're all wrong. They do not follow the original case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. You would think these courts hadn't even read the case. And I saw so much misinformation being spread about Jacobson. Jacobson did not say what the courts are saying it said. These people haven't read the case. And so I go into detail about that and explain why it's so critical to follow Jacobson as per its own words. Because I believe Jacobson was rightly decided in 1905 based on the medical evidence at hand at that time, and based on the fact that there was an alternative to vaccination, and that was paying a $5 fine. So it's either get vaccinated or pay a $5 fine. That is a radically different situation than what we have today. And most importantly, it involved a very lethal disease, smallpox, that had been killing anywhere from 20 to 60% of people in various regions, and an overall 30% death toll. And with babies, the death toll was about 93% during some periods. So we're talking about a devastating, deadly disease that was, you know, sweeping around the world. And we're talking about a vaccine that had been in use in one form or another for a century. And when the court started talking about this medical urgent situation in Jacobson, they detailed the medical evidence. This was so critical. The Supreme Court detailed the medical evidence about whether vaccination was effective, whether there were any other ways to control the spread of smallpox, and the court found on its own there weren't any other ways to control smallpox. The vaccine was what everyone was using, militaries around the world, and it's all in the footnote to the decision. So the court recognized its role in the separation of powers as the protector of individual liberties against the democratic branches, because the president and Congress are elected portions of our government. The courts are unelected for a reason. The courts enjoy life tenure because they are bound to protect the interests of the individuals in our country who are oftentimes discrete and insular minorities, people who can't engage the democratic process to safeguard themselves. And so the courts are bound to safeguard those little people from majoritarian influences. So it is the court's duty to protect individual liberties, the right of religion, religious freedom, practicing all that. That is the court's role. And what we've seen over the course of a century is the courts just throwing up their hands and deferring to legislatures. Meanwhile, studies have shown over and over again that our legislators are largely invested in big pharma. So the same companies who are making a ton of money off vaccines have basically bought a lot of our legislators. It is a real problem. This is why the courts are so critical to defending us all individually against these, you know, these majoritarian influences that have been purchased by these billionaire companies and billionaires like Bill Gates. So for them to shrug their hands at this point and say, well, you know, we're going to defer to the agency. No, that is not their role. It's not the way the Constitution was written. And we need them now more than ever. And this is exactly what the dissent said in the opinion from Friday, or it's part of what they said. They said a lot of things. But I just read the 57-page opinion from the Sixth Circuit. And it's just, it's so clearly one of those situations where the court is looking to justify an outcome. It's an outcome-driven decision. One of the things that bothers me a lot is that they keep saying, well, the vaccine is so important to protect the unvaccinated. Well, where's the evidence that the vaccine actually works? They keep saying, oh, it'll prevent transmission. No, it doesn't. Our own leading authorities have said, okay, it doesn't prevent transmission. It doesn't prevent infection. In fact, it isn't even a vaccine. The CDC changed the definition of vaccine in August of 2021 to allow these agents to be called vaccines. And the reason they did that was because then they could engage all the vaccine jurisprudence and say, oh, vaccines have always passed constitutional muster. No, not exactly. But you see what they're doing. They've got these mRNA treatments categorized as vaccines only by changing the definition of vaccines. Because
this is Jim Fetzer. Please leave a message, and I'll get back at my earliest opportunity.
I know what's going on here.
Sorry, hello? I was trying to get a hold of Jim to bring him into the show on his cell phone, and I guess he it picked up on his cell phone. But I'll message Jim and tell him to call in, and then we'll get with us. Go ahead and continue, Deanna.
Oh, so basically my background consists of being a constitutional law professor and studying the structure of the Constitution, the separation of powers, federalism, which means the separation between the state and federal governments. Normally the separation of powers, we refer to the branches, the three branches, but federalism is more, well, all of it's involved right now. We're talking about, you know, the Congress's power to delegate to OSHA the authority to make day-to-day health policy, which I think exceeds its authority. And that's what the Fifth Circuit said. We're also talking about OSHA's unusual procedure here. They're engaging this emergency aspect of their power, which means they bypass all of the normal procedures to have hearings and have the public object to these the mandate. It's like they're bulldozing through the democratic processes and doing so at the 2-year mark, after we've already had this thing in circulation for 2 years. And at a point where they're saying, oh, this Omicron version is, it's really transmissible. Yeah, it's also less deadly. And by the way, it also has a very different spike protein than the original COVID-19. Meaning, if you understand the mRNA technology, it's not a vaccine at all. It sends a messenger into your DNA. It shuts down your immune system temporarily to get that information into your DNA so that your body will create the spike proteins. That is not how vaccines work traditionally. This is a genetic coding. So they're not even telling people that. And so the spike protein that your body is told to create, and we're talking it makes trillions of these spike proteins, it's completely different than the Omicron version anyway. And my niece-in-law, who's a doctor, sat down and explained this to me in her house a couple of weeks ago and said, there's no way the vaccine is really going to work with the Omicron variant because the spike protein is different. I'm getting tremendous feedback. I can't even talk right now. This is terrible.
Hey, Jim, take your phone off speaker if you have it on speaker.
I did.
Okay, go ahead, Jim. Deanna?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know where we left off or what, how you want to start. I don't know if we're on the air right now.
The spike protein was different. The vaccine wouldn't even work on it because it was so different.
Well, yeah. I mean, are we on the air right now?
Yes.
No, okay, look, I got knocked off. I can't connect with the computer. My phone is not even working. I'm calling you on the cell by way of the call-in line, Dina. I'm just so thrilled you're here. And okay. I want you to continue. Just go ahead. You were on a roll, and I'm sorry that I had it on speaker that created the feedback.
That's okay.
I've taken it
I just
off.
Wasn't,
go for it.
I wasn't okay. Oh, I wasn't sure if we were on air or not. What I was talking about was this vaccine. You know, is just the medical evidence concerning its efficacy, and particularly concerning whether it can you know, help with this Omicron variant is completely, the evidence isn't there. And no one is talking about that. I read the 52-page opinion just now this morning, issued by the Sixth Circuit on Friday. On Wednesday, the en banc request was denied 8-8 because there's 16 judges on the Sixth Circuit. The Chief Justice wrote a dissent from the refusal to provide an en banc review. And I haven't been able to read all of that, but he makes a lot of the same points as the dissent. Remember, this is a 2-1 decision issued by the Sixth Circuit on Friday that dissolved the stay that the Fifth Circuit had issued to stop the OSHA 100 employee or more, you know, rule. Either they all get vaccinated or they have these pretty onerous, you know, weekly tests plus protective face covering. So I was, why don't I start back with what the court did on Friday, because they overturned the Fifth Circuit's decision, which I had read and reported on earlier and published something on the Daily Clout, which is Naomi Wolf's news source. And basically the court said, there's just so many problems with this. And among the problems, there's so many problems. On the first level is the problem of, you know, does Congress have the authority under Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution to make, you know, day in and day out health policy? And a lot of people say no. If you look at Article 1, Section 8 and the enumerated powers vested in Congress by our framers, the founding fathers, they were limited in nature for a reason. Our framers were concerned about national power being too strong, being too dangerous, being too oppressive. And so they limited the powers of the federal government, but had no such limitation for the state governments. They weren't worried about state power. They were worried about federal oppressive power. So the federal legislature's powers are very limited and circumscribed in the Constitution, and everything else goes to the states. That's the 10th Amendment. So the states have all the powers that aren't enumerated. So the first level of concern is, does Congress have the authority under the Constitution to regulate health policy? And they're grabbing the Commerce Clause. They're latching on, because they have to find a clause. They have to find an enumerated power. Every time Congress acts, they have to point to one of the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 to say, here, this is our authority right here. So they're pointing to the Commerce Clause. And the Commerce Clause is an interesting clause, because when you look at it and you read it, and I have it actually right here, it sure sounds like they're trying to regulate interstate commerce. That means, you know, traffic and controlling the highways, making sure that, you know, things are orderly in that. However, the Commerce Clause has been interpreted extremely broadly over the course of the last century. And in fact, when I was in law school in 1987 and had Erwin Chemerinsky as my con law professor, we were told that if Congress acts under the Commerce Clause, the court's pretty much going to uphold anything they do, because that was true back then. 60 years of Commerce Clause legislation, nothing struck down. That changed, though, around 1989 or somewhere in there, when the U.S. Supreme Court composition changed and they started knocking down congressional acts that they passed under the Commerce Clause. So the Commerce Clause has its own history of, you know, how far does it go? What does it mean? So the first question is, does Congress even have the power? The next question is, and some people are saying no. And the next question is, assuming Congress has the power, because they have created OSHA a long time ago, 1970, to control the workplace. The next question is, did Congress clearly give the authority to OSHA to regulate in this manner, this level of specificity with vaccine policy and that sort of thing? And a lot of people are saying no, they didn't. I mean, even if you assume Congress has the power, which I question, I don't like the way the Commerce Clause has been interpreted over the years. But even assuming they have the power, did they properly delegate it? And that's the second. Now, the third layer of problem, and I'm still talking about what we call structural arguments under the Constitution. Who has the power? Whether the power was delegated properly. So I'm still on the structural issues of the Constitution. I haven't even gotten to the individual liberties yet. So on the structural constitutional issues alone, we have layers of problems. So I've talked about the problem, does Congress have the power? Next question, did Congress clearly delegate that power to OSHA? Next question, has OSHA abided by its own regulations? You see, what you're seeing in the situation is a lot of bypassing of democratic processes. OSHA engaged in emergency aspect of its power to basically bypass its own regulatory power in terms of having public input and processes to determine whether this order is valid, whether it's acceptable. They bypass that as well. So there's three layers of problems just structurally with what OSHA did. And that's what the Fifth Circuit sort of honed in on. And then also the Fifth Circuit said back in November that OSHA didn't follow its own procedures. And took positions directly contrary to its prior statements it had issued. So it looked like a knee-jerk sort of urgent attempt to sell vaccines. It didn't come off as kosher at all. So it was so urgent and so important. Why didn't OSHA act for the last 2 years? So that's a lot of what the Fifth Circuit said. And it was also over-inclusive and under-inclusive. And the Fifth Circuit said, you know, this would apply to any security guard company where the security guards work alone on a night shift with no chance of exposing anyone else to any germs they have. But it wouldn't apply to a daycare with 30 employees who have 50 children or 100 children in there with a high likelihood of transmission because children swap spit. I mean, they put toys in their mouth. They do all sorts of things. Daycare centers are hotbeds of germ transmission, and yet the OSHA rule didn't apply to them. It didn't make a lot of sense. So it was both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. I'm not going to get to the second layer of analysis yet, because this order that issued on Friday by the Sixth Circuit dissolving the Fifth Circuit stay on Biden's 99 or more employees mandate for vaccinating everyone or having these onerous, you know, weekly tests and mask wearing, you know, without any endpoint. So we're still on the structural issues. I will get to the individual liberty interests later, and that's where the Jacobson case comes in, and that's what I've been writing on and publishing on recently, and that's the subject of my Florida State University Law Review article coming out in April of 2022. So let me just say what the court did. You could often tell by the first sentence of a court's opinion where they lean, what they're looking at doing. The first sentence by Jane Straunch is, the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc across America, leading to the loss of over 800,000 lives, shutting down workplaces and jobs across the country, and threatening our economy. I would argue right there, that's not accurate. What has shut down our economy or threatened our economy is the shutdowns. What has destroyed so many jobs and workplaces and small businesses is the shutdowns, not the virus. And by the way, 800,000 lives, yeah, that's not good. However, the flu kills a couple hundred thousand every year. And one of the things that Reiner Fulmick has been saying is that if you look at the statistics on how many people are actually dying from COVID-19, it's about the same as statistically the number who die every year of the flu. And the flu is a coronavirus. COVID-19 is a coronavirus. Every common cold is a coronavirus. And coronaviruses are not amenable to vaccines because they mutate all the time. That's why the flu vaccines have a dismal efficacy rate. The CDC claims 40%. Even that isn't a very good rate. But the Cochrane collaboration came out and said, no, it's like a 1% efficacy rate. So they're forced vaccinating all these people, for example, in New York, in all of the assisted care facilities. And by the way, based on research I obtained with a bunch of people around the world working with Children's Health Defense and some other agencies, as far as we know, all of the old people who died in New York in those assisted care facilities all had the flu vaccine before they caught COVID. So there was a question as well, did the flu vaccine prime them? Did it hurt their body? Is that why they died? We don't know the answer. What we do know is that coronavirus vaccines have historically not worked well. Because the coronaviruses mutate so fast. So first the court, and by the way, it's a 2-1 decision. So we've got Straunch and Gibbons on the one side saying we're gonna lift the stay, lift the injunction by the Fifth Circuit, and Larson writing a very strong dissent saying this is just not kosher. And so the first thing they do is they try to say, you know, this is such an historically unprecedented virus in the workplace, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if I even agree with that premise to start with. Yes, a lot of people have died, and yes, it's kind of grotesque what's happening to people.
Well, so Dina, you and Heinrich are exactly on the right track, because they've simply reclassified. Last year there were 38 million cases of the flu this year, 2000. They simply reclassified the flu as,
exactly,
as COVID.
And, what's going
and there
on?
There is no
it's
increase
so...
in death. I mean, people are dying all the time. It's just that they're being said to have died from COVID when they may or may not have even died with COVID, but not from COVID. That's virtually unheard of. It's virtually not happening. The statistics are totally fraudulent. Totally fraudulent.
Well, there's so much fraud going on here. I'm absolutely devastated. As a con law scholar, I've never seen anything like this. It's shocking to me. Everyone's just glossing over the facts, the medical facts that were so important in the original vaccine case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, where the court did its job. And let me just quickly explain Jacobson to sort of get back to this. Jacobson said a lot of things. It was before we adopted strict scrutiny and rational basis review. And of course, most people know rational basis review has in that kind of review, the judiciary defers to the legislature and says, you know what, it's not an important right, it's not a fundamental right, we're going to defer to the policymakers here. Strict scrutiny is the opposite. The judiciary takes an active role and says, we need to look at whether this is actually, you know, necessary, narrowly tailored. Are there less intrusive alternatives? Because if there aren't, then the legislature has exceeded its authority to interfere with people's individual liberties. So Jacobson, even though it didn't adopt the standard yet, because it didn't have those standards didn't exist until Caroline Products years later. But what the court did is it said our obligation is to uphold liberties, the liberty interests of individuals. And the court made that very clear in the opinion. And the court did so by examining in detail the medical evidence of the efficacy of smallpox and the risk to the community of smallpox. After the court satisfied itself that the vaccine was highly effective and the smallpox epidemic was highly dangerous to society, then and only then did they say, in this situation, we're going to defer to the legislature because we've determined for ourselves we are adequately upholding the liberty interests of individuals, and therefore we can now defer to the legislature on the vaccine policy. But keep in mind, the policy included that you could not get vaccinated and pay a $5 fine. Okay, so that wasn't even, I don't see that rule as particularly egregious to begin with. $5 fine today would be about $145. So back to what OSHA did.
It seems to me this argument about the unprecedented is all extra constitutional. It's as though they're making this up on the fly. The fact that court have heard this case when it's of such great moment.
I'm having trouble hearing you, but the constitutional, the structural issues are a big problem to me, but the individual liberty aspect is also a problem. So let me just explain the difference. With structural constitutional arguments, the people who are not in favor of the vaccine mandate are saying, you don't have the authority, federal government, Biden, Congress, OSHA, to do this. That's the structural argument. The other side of it is the individual liberty arguments, and those come into play definitely when the state and local governments act and create mandates, because now we don't have a structural argument. Now we have the fact that the states have always had the general police power authorities, the power to regulate health under the 10th Amendment. So now we have to shift and say, okay, it's not a structural constitutional argument. Now it's an individual liberty argument. But this case comes down to structure, and they didn't say much about individual liberty until you get to the dissent who says, wait a minute, you know, what about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act? What about this? What about this? So let me just continue on with what the two judges, I mean, it's so frustrating to me. Two to one is the decision above the Sixth Circuit on Friday, which means one person, one judge threw the tie.
Yes.
And one person is going to make, it's going to allow forced vaccination of what, 80 million Americans? This is troubling to me. So the next thing is they have, OSHA did not act in the normal course of business. This is really, really, really important because OSHA normally has to go through a bunch of processes to create standards to regulate safety in the workplace. They didn't do that. They had 2 years to do that. They didn't do that. They engaged this emergency exception where they can promulgate emergency temporary standards to take place immediately without process.
We have a hard break. We'll be right back.
Yeah, we need a better, Jim, we have to have a better connection. This is terrible. This is so awful for me.
Listen to the radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence.
I've got a question or two for you.
The hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I told you that I had a fabulous guest today, and she has shown herself to be exactly that. I have two questions for Dina. One has to do with an issue she may have already covered, at least in part, about the distribution between the powers of the different branches of government. It seems to me in this case, executive branch is usurping the role of the legislative by making up laws as it goes along. And I just want clarification on that. The second is, These different decisions by the court suggest to the public that there's a political, this whole matter of the law is political, and it undermines confidence in the rule of law and the objectivity of the judiciary. Your thoughts about either or both?
Well, I'm not sure what your first question is. Are you asking about the what we were talking about before the break in terms of the structure of the Constitution and who has power to enact these kinds of ordinances and health policies?
Yes, yes, yes. Isn't the executive preempting the legislative by issuing these mandates as though they were laws? I mean, they're not laws, and I think...
Right. What then is a squirrely, around the normal processes type mandate to create a lot of constitutional confusion, because that's what is done routinely when the government is trying to get away with something. They engage emergency procedures, unusual protocols, unusual types of orders and mandates. And if you ever read Naomi Wolf's book called The End of America, she chronicles how every single fascist takeover has involved an emergency and emergency procedures that bypass normal democratic processes. This is what they do when they're trying to shift it toward a totalitarian government. And so that is very, very concerning to me. But to come down to the specifics of this case and what's happening in this case is OSHA didn't act for a couple years on this so-called emergency, this so-called pandemic, which is really more like a regular flu than something like smallpox in terms of the number of deaths and the risks to people. And they've engaged this emergency procedure they have to bypass their own normal processes. So OSHA is bypassing its own review process and saying it's an emergency and we can act temporarily for up to 6 months without any real process. And so they've issued this thing through not through regular processes, but through this unusual circumstance. And then, in my opinion, they didn't even meet their own standards, which is what the dissent said in the Sixth Circuit opinion from Friday. So they kind of went around about how, you know, there's options here. The employers don't have to require vaccination. They can then, what they have to do is determine for themselves how best to minimize the risk of COVID-19 in their workplaces. And they have the option to require unvaccinated people to wear a mask and to test for COVID-19 weekly. Those compliance costs are pretty serious, though. And so what the employers are doing, which almost anyone would do, would say, you know what, let's just opt for the first option. Let's just force them all to get vaccinated. And this, of course, is causing a lot of unemployment, a lot of anger. And they have this standard penalty that employers who fail to follow the standard are fined up to $13,653 for each violation and up to $136,532 for each willful violation. That's under 29 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 1903.15. So they've put enormous pressure on these employers to just go the easy route and make everyone get vaccinated. The problem is no one is looking at the medical evidence about the efficacy and risks concerning this vaccine. And that is an absolutely critical aspect of it because they're saying, oh my God, we have to act. It's a necessary. Remember, if it's an emergency standard under OSHA, it's a different standard. They have to show it's necessary and they have to show that it's, you know, critical. If it's a regular OSHA procedure where they go through the processes, the standards are a little lower, and that's what the dissent is honing in on, is that this is an emergency procedure. They have to show at a higher level how critically important it is to force vaccination. And I was appalled, quite frankly, by the majority opinion, the two justices, who went around and around talking about how, oh, there's this evidence that the vaccine is working, and they're citing things like the OSHA's own findings. Okay, well, if OSHA isn't acting on the up and up to begin with, why would anyone rely on their findings? They also rely on an NPR study. Well, I don't know how much your listeners know, but NPR the science division of NPR has been taken over by Bill Gates. And the Columbia, what's it called? The Columbia Journal of, I think it's called, hang on, let me find this exact quote here. The Columbia University's journalism department has a periodical called the Columbia Journalism Review. And they had an article on August 21st of 2020 called Journalism's Gatekeepers, Gates as in Bill Gates, and talking about how much money he's putting into the NPR to influence what they say. So now the court is relying on OSHA's statements, justifying their onerous, and I think completely unconstitutional vaccination mandate. And then they're relying on NPR data, which is run by Bill Gates, who is not run by Bill Gates, but is influenced greatly by Bill Gates. And he's the biggest vaccine investor in the world. And so it's like a circle. It's, who is going to get off this crazy wheel and stop and say, wait a minute, what about the other side of the vaccines? What about all the research that says it's not working? These are not really even vaccines. They had to change the mRNA, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are mRNA treatments to their they send in a messenger into your DNA to tell your DNA to make the spike protein to the original COVID-19, and then your body makes the spike protein, then learns to deal with it. A regular vaccine, a traditional vaccine, prevents infection and transmission by introducing a partial or weakened virus into your body to give your body a head start on how to attack that virus. So when the real one comes along, you've already seen it before, so to speak. You've already have some immunity built up against it. This is a very different technology. Your cells are changed, as I understand it from my research, for the rest of your life. Not just that, when people who are vaccinated with mRNA vaccines have babies, those babies' DNA has been altered. This is a life altering treatment, and it's experimental. And even though the FDA did approve one of their vaccines, they've been sued because they bypassed all the regular procedures in doing that. They walked in and voted to give FDA approval to one kind of vaccine, and I believe they did that because the military law says they cannot require vaccines of the military men if those vaccines have not been FDA approved. So Todd Callender filed a lawsuit against the vaccine mandate in the military, and the FDA ran in, approved this one vaccine with no process, again, bypassing processes, and then, now it's FDA approved. But guess what? They weren't even giving that vaccine to the military after that FDA approval. That's why Todd Callender filed this lawsuit saying that is completely beyond what we've ever allowed under military law. The other thing is, military men who've had a particular disease cannot be forced to get the vaccine. My son falls in that category. He was diagnosed with COVID last November, December. He didn't even know he had it. He felt tired for a couple of days. So the military told him, hey, you've tested positive for COVID. Now they want to force vaccinate him. Another huge violation of military law where you cannot require soldiers to get vaccinated if they've had natural immunity to a particular antigen. So you're seeing all these bypassing of long-standing procedures. And this again goes back to the whole idea of when a government is in the process of having a takeover happen, they're going to shut down regular processes. They're going to shut down the First Amendment rights, the right to assemble. All these things are happening right now. And if I hadn't read Naomi Wolf's book, I wouldn't be nearly as disturbed. But it's really scary to me that we're seeing exactly what basically she predicted in 2007. It's coming to pass right now, and people are looking the other way. So the majority opinion, the two justices last Friday, they're saying, this vaccine, they're saying it prevents transmission. No, it doesn't. We know that from Fauci's and others, even the bad guys like Fauci are admitting that it doesn't really prevent transmission, it doesn't really prevent infection. What it does supposedly is help the body to fight an infection if you get it. So if it doesn't prevent transmission, why is the court saying this in the middle of its opinion? And do they even look at the research? They're ignoring all the research on not just the efficacy of the mRNA vaccines and all of the COVID vaccines. They're also ignoring all the risks, all the deaths. If you look at the reporting website, there's been more injuries and more death from the COVID-19 vaccines than all other vaccines combined throughout history. These are dangerous experimental vaccines. The idea they could force all people to take them, it's mind-boggling to me. So I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do with this, because last Wednesday, the Sixth Circuit declined to grant what's called en banc review with all 16 judges involved. It was an 8-8 decision. And the Chief Justice wrote a dissent saying we need to deal with this because of all the problems we've talked about. I briefly looked at his introduction. It was another 42-page opinion I didn't have time to read today. But we're seeing all these strange, ignoring all the processes that should be in place. And so, yes. You have a brave danger. Go ahead.
No, no, I think you're nailing it. You're nailing it, Dina. This is totally political. It's totally unprecedented. They're violating the law. They're blatantly violating the law. They know damn well they're blatantly violating the law. This is destroying American belief in our judicial system and the rule of law. The consequences are enormous.
They're asking for full-on anarchy. Our people know better, okay? Our people know this is not. And here to say, oh, we should demonstrate the pervasive danger that COVID-19 poses to unvaccinated workers. Wait a minute. If the unvaccinated workers, this is on page 21 of the opinion from last Friday, if they're worrying about unvaccinated workers, let them assume the risk. And they say, OSHA explains why the mechanics of COVID-19 transmission make our traditional workers. Wait a minute, we already know that transmission is not stopped by these vaccines. We know that. They're therapeutic treatments, they're not traditional vaccines. Then it says, then the court goes on to say on the same page, 21, transmissibility is possible from those who are symptomatic, asymptomatic, or pre-symptomatic, and variants are likely to be more transmissible. Okay, wait a minute, Fauci said just the opposite. He said, well, it's possible. I mean, there is such a thing as typhoid Mary. Sure, I mean, it's possible. And it's possible that someone with herpes who does not have an outbreak could shed. It's possible to get herpes from someone who does not have a herpes outbreak. It's extremely rare. Almost all of your transmission is going to come from somebody who is sick. And so they're going on and on about all these things that we know otherwise, and we've had opposite statements. And I wish I had the chance to finish the real Anthony Fauci book by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., because he goes into some of the things, some of the shenanigans that were pulled, and some of how Fauci says one thing and then a few months later says the exact opposite. And no one is tracing his statements except in this book. Yep. He does that and says, look, this is ridiculous. And then on page 23, OSHA further estimated that the stand would save over 6,500 worker lives and prevent over 250,000 hospitalizations. How did they come up with that? This is just out, and the court keeps citing OSHA's findings. Well, if OSHA is acting beyond its authority in an ultra-virus manner, then why would you expect any of its findings supporting its improper action to be valid? Then the court goes on to cite NPR. Oh, wait. Oh, that's Gates's baby now. It's just, I'm looking at this saying, this is unbelievable that they're completely ignoring all of the death and injuries that have been caused by this vaccine and acting like it's going to somehow help people. I don't buy that to begin with. I don't think the vaccine is efficacious. I don't think it's anywhere near as efficacious as having a very good lifestyle, eating right, having your vitamin D, a proper level of vitamin D, you're getting exercise. I mean, these things we know enhance immunity for everything that comes along, no matter whether it's a virus or bacterial infection or a fungal infection. There are ways to increase your immunity that don't necessarily include a vaccine. And I would argue that very healthy people who spent their lives, you know, dedicating themselves to their body as a temple, those people are healthier and less likely to transmit any virus than a vaccinated person who is less healthy. So I just, they're like completely ignoring all that we know about immunity and all that we know about the immune system and saying, oh, if you don't have this vaccine, your body can't fight it. Our bodies have been fighting germs and microbes for so many centuries. And now suddenly this coronavirus germ, it's killing, 0.1% or whatever it is suddenly this huge pandemic as if it's the bubonic plague. It's like, are people not paying attention to the statistics? Are they not paying attention to what's going on here? Because it would seem to me that they are not. Now, going on to the necessity, remember, when OSHA acts suddenly in an emergency situation, they have to show that it's necessary. Okay, they just kind of glossed over that as well. They deferred to OSHA, saying, you know, well, you know, they're saying it's going to, you know, alleviate a risk in the workplace, even though we've gone for 2 years without it. Now they're saying it's suddenly, you know, important to combat the transmission of COVID, they say on page 27. Wait a minute. We already have data. It does not stop transmission. It's a therapeutic vaccine that is supposed to help the body to fight COVID-19, you know, especially the elderly. They're saying there's some research that indicates that if you are elderly and if you survive the vaccine, which my mother did not and my cousin's cousin did not, my cousin's cousin died 3 days after the first dose of Moderna. My mom died about 3 months after the second dose of Pfizer. These are women who were doing well, working out, and they were older, you know, 79 and 80. But, I mean, they're bypassing all the risks and saying, it combats transmission. We know this is not a traditional vaccine. It doesn't prevent transmission. Everyone knows that now. So why is the court saying this? Oh, they're, you know, citing again OSHA's findings. So they say extensive evidence cited by OSHA shows that vaccination reduces the presence of and severity in the workplace. That's not exactly true. Again, citing OSHA's findings. Where are all of the findings by certain doctors who've come forward and they've described this is not true? And we have, and that's one of the things that is honed in on the real Anthony Fauci book, talking about why are these people being shut down? They're being threatened. They're being told to shut up. And doctors who are seeking to, who were seeking to provide hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin early on when they know it works, they were shut down. The FDA shut down the availability of these medications. And on top of that, as described in the book, the studies were created to give ivermectin and or hydroxychloroquine to COVID patients after they were sick for 2 weeks. Everyone knows it doesn't work when you've been sick for 2 weeks. You have to take hydroxychloroquine and or ivermectin in the first 48 hours of COVID or it doesn't work. So they constructed these studies with the intent to have a finding that didn't work, but everyone knew it wouldn't work if given so late in the game. So we're seeing nothing but just fraud and attempts to hide the truth and to push this vaccine on our people.
Actually, there's some evidence that even patients who are on their deathbed have been saved by ivermectin and Dina. So they're just suppressing. If there were these readily available methods for dealing with it, they cannot have the emergency use authority. And if they cannot have the emergency use authority, they cannot keep the ingredient secret. And if they cannot keep the ingredient secret, no one's going to take them because what's in there is a horror story, parasites, graphene oxide, a host of other very bad things are in these vaccines. So it's a very elaborate scam. It's a very elaborate scam.
Right. And I also learned, in January, February of this year when I was part of Children's Self-Defense PCR group with Chaim at Reiner, that they have, you know, there's a potential to put other things in as well. For example, nanobots or you know, pieces of material that can actually be, and there's some good medical technology behind it. I mean, there's some great purposes behind this medical technology. For example, these nanobots that can be put into the body can deliver medication to places in the body that you couldn't reach to traditional purposes. So it's not like this isn't a great technology or couldn't be a great technology, but as with any great technology, it can be misused. What else could they do to you if they had a negative intent? Just like the internet, it's great. You can get so much information so fast, but also can disseminate a lot of untrue information. And something that I found that alarmed me when I saw on page 34 what this two-person majority court said, Congress has already addressed the issue about expressing its intention to preempt state and local standards that conflict with OSHA standards. Okay, what that told me, the writing is on the wall, they're going to try to use this OSHA mandate to preempt Governor Abbott's order saying that Texans cannot be forced to get this vaccine. That's what preemption means, that federal law supersedes state law. That's the preemption doctrine, unless it can be, if they're at odds with one another. That's where you'll see any immigration laws that any state or local government would try to pass. It's all preempted because it's clear in the Constitution is that immigration is something that Congress has control over. And when Congress passes its immigration legislation, it makes clear they intend to occupy the entire area of immigration law. So state and local governments cannot act in that regard. It's all preempted by Congress's power. When I saw that on page 34, I'm like, oh, no, what I read that to mean is they're going to try to say that all the governors who've tried to protect their people and their states from these mandates, I think the writing's on the wall. They're going to say OSHA, Congress's baby, preempts all that. And I think you're going to find real problems. I think you're going to find noncompliance, and you're going to find fights now on the basis of federalism. Can OSHA preempt the order by someone like Governor Abbott? I don't think so. I think it's a 10th Amendment issue, but we'll see that later. So there's all these other little constitutional doctrines that were brought up, the non-delegation doctrine. It's not very important to me because it talks about, you know, the methodology by which the Congress must explain specifically what kind of delegation they're given to another agency. But then we're looking at the irreparable harm. And the majority says, you know, that's speculative, blah, blah. And they say, like, four times in the opinion, oh, 800,000 people have died, 800,000 people have died. Like that's the end-all, be-all statistic that matters. I don't see it that way at all. I see it as, you know, 800,000 people died. That's terrible. You know, and for most of those people, probably had they led healthier lifestyles, they may not have died. Had they taken personal responsibility for their own health, they may not have died. So there's a lot that goes into this. There's a lot of confounding factors as to why some people die from a particular virus and some don't. But the bottom line is, this is not smallpox. This is not a black plague. This is a virus, a coronavirus. And so that the whole premise is off. Now, when you look at the dissent, you know, by Larson, here's where I, you know, I see some common sense. They're saying the emergency rule is supposed to have these specific safeguards, these very serious safeguards, to make sure that OSHA doesn't engage this emergency rule without the normal processes and overstep their boundaries. And they did that here, I think. And the OSHA actually says the purpose of the mandate is to protect unvaccinated people. The dissent says this on page 40. And the rule's premise is that vaccines work, again, on page 40. Well, where is the evidence that actually works? The entire opinion is devoid of real medical evidence saying these vaccines work to stop transmission and stop infection and to reduce death. There's a little bit in there about how elderly people can have a reduction in the likelihood of death if they catch COVID post-vaccine. But they also point out, the dissent points out, that the risk to older people who are vaccinated, like ages 50 to 64, whatever it is, are the same as the risk to people ages 18 to, I'm not sure what it is, 40 or something, who are unvaccinated. So, you know, the people who are anywhere from, and let's talk about the five-year-olds. I mean, these kids almost never die from coronavirus, if ever. I mean, if a child dies of coronavirus, there's something else going on. And now they're forced vaccinating children in California. And I have a case that I'm probably going to file a lawsuit on where a five-year-old little Hispanic boy was brought into the nurse's office and demanded his paperwork for his vaccine. And the child was scared. He didn't know. He didn't have the paperwork. And they shoved a needle into his arm and vaccinated him without consent of the parent. And the parent doesn't speak English, and she's upside down, super upset, as she should be. And that's a case where I think we're going to get a remedy. That goes way, way, way beyond the issue of whether a vaccine can be mandated, because no vaccine has ever been mandated in the history of the United States without some out. The out could be a $5 fine. The out could be withdrawing your child from public school. The out could be homeschooling. The out, there's a lot of outs. And this child had a needle stuck in his arm with no authority. It's an outrage. And that goes to show how this, we're so divided as a people. This should not be a political issue. It's become a Republican-Democrat issue. I believe the Democratic Party today is the most corrupt party in the history of the world. The Democrats were the ones supporting, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby. They're so tied into the Democratic Party, the wealth, Bill Gates, all these people who are billionaires, and for whatever reason, they seem to have captured the Democratic Party. I was a Democrat most of my life, from law school all the way until just a few years ago, and I departed from the Democratic Party because I could not believe the oppressive behaviors of the party, and even the ACLU, who we've just, you know, relied upon for decades to protect our civil liberties, they're now you know, agreeing with the vaccine mandates. This is senseless. This is the American Civil Liberties Union. Oh, but wait. Again, they've been kind of captured by the Democratic Party. Everyone's capturing everyone else right now. And it's just this massive group of public entities, public officials, private entities, billionaires, Hollywood people, all kind of on the same side here, and they own the media. And another really, really important point, because what we saw when I wrote the books on Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, and Bill Cosby, I discussed in detail not just the shenanigans in the courthouses and how the courts were just bending, the prosecutors were bending over backwards to help the predators. Alexander Acosta helped Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, they were meeting in private, sneaking around. It was disgusting. Cy Vance in New York was helping Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein. And then you have Bruce Castor in Philadelphia bending over backwards to protect Bill Cosby. So our trusted prosecutors were helping the bad guys. And I feel like we're seeing the same thing now. We're seeing the government trying to protect the vaccine manufacturers who are already immunized for liability for vaccines injuries. They use our taxpayer dollars for research and development. They use our taxpayer dollars to pay for all injuries. There's this thing called the vaccine court that's tucked away in D.C. with their abbreviated, almost non-existent procedures. They don't get discovery. They don't get, I mean, it's like a workers' compensation scheme, but it's been totally corrupted. And so the vaccine manufacturers are, there's nothing like the vaccine manufacturers in the history of our country. They're completely immune from the consequences of their products. The injuries are hidden, tucked away. They're not open to the public. They don't have normal procedure. It's just, it's the most corrupt thing I've ever seen, which is why I spent the whole last summer, or the summer of 2020, writing that article. So the majority opinion to me just act of attempting to find, to uphold this OSHA regulation that I just think is so outrageous, and I still haven't gotten to the individual liberty issue. I'm still talking federal constitution.
Do you know when the exemption from liability was orchestrated, and I take it Fauci had a role in that with playing Ronald Reagan for SAP, wasn't the definition then of a vaccine specific enough that it would not include the mRNA doses, the injections, which aren't even medicine and don't deserve to be exempt from liability?
There is a lot of, yes. I mean, the vaccine definition changed in, I think it was August of 2021, to allow these so-called vaccines to be called vaccines. They would not have been allowed to be called vaccines before 2021 when the CDC changed the definition. The vaccines no longer have to prevent transmission. They no longer have to prevent infection. They can just be some kind of a, you know, biological, you know, therapeutic medicine that may or may not, you know, help people to combat the virus if they get it. But then at the same time, it carries these huge risks. But let me jump back to 1986 when Ronald Reagan was president and this National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was passed. What happened was the vaccine manufacturers had been sued and lost so badly in court because children getting so sick or dying from vaccines that they went running to Congress, you know, help us, protect us from our own products, you know, deadliness and you know, illness-producing effects. And Congress decided to pass this act to protect the vaccine manufacturers instead of saying, hey, guys, why don't you make a vaccine that doesn't kill kids? Why don't you do your job, do due diligence better? Well, there's some reasons for that, because in medicine, there are unavoidable risks. There's really no way of knowing how medicine is going to work for sure until it's in people's bodies. And so there is such a thing as unavoidable risks. So when Reagan was asked to sign this act, the Justice Department begged him to veto it. They said, if you sign this, it's going to be a disaster for our children. You're going to see more illness, more sloppy vaccines, whatever the case is. And Reagan was in a very difficult position because on the one hand, we were on the cusp of biological warfare, and our vaccine manufacturers were the entities doing the research on vaccines so that if we did get hit with a biological weapon, we would have something to protect our people from dying from these biological weapons. So they really kind of had to stay in business, and they were threatening to pull out and to not do the research anymore. So Reagan, and of course the Justice Department is begging Reagan not to sign it, but Reagan reluctantly signed it. He said that he was torn apart, but he had to sign it, he felt, and I think he probably, in that situation, under all the circumstances, I think he probably made the right decision. But look what's happened after that. The number of vaccines kids are subjected to went from, I don't know, a dozen or so to over 70. The vaccine manufacturers have made just tons of money off vaccines because now they're immunized. And then a really horrible decision, in my opinion, came down in 2011 in a case called Brucewitz, because the lawyers realized, you know, we're not going to win these product defect cases, so let's try a theory of negligence. Now, as a torts professor of 20 years, I can tell you the theory of liability for negligence is vastly different than strict liability. Negligence goes way back to the common law. Strict liability also goes back in certain categories like trespassing cattle, but the real products liability started in the 60s, and that happened when the California Supreme Court said that products, injuries from products do not sound in contract, they sound in tort. And so they said that if a product is dangerous, there can be strict liability without any fault of the product manufacturer because the risk to the people is too high and the product manufacturers can pay for the injuries. And so when the act was passed in 1986 and signed by Reagan, that's what it was designed to do, is protect the manufacturers from defects that they couldn't really predict and they couldn't control. But in this case of negligence, a totally different theory of liability where you have to prove the defendant knew or should have known that they were taking an unreasonable risk of harm toward the people who were taking the vaccines, and they didn't bother protecting against that unreasonable risk of harm to a satisfactory level. That's called negligence. The court extended the act to cover vaccine manufacturer negligence. And Justice Sotomayor wrote a very compelling dissent, a heartfelt dissent, saying this is not good. It's going to subject our kids to so much injury when the vaccine manufacturers could have taken more precautions and didn't bother. That's an enormous expansion of the act from 1986. So now what we're left basically with is a fraud-based theory or intentional theory, which I continue to say would allow for liability because, again, it's an entirely different theory of liability, and we've never seen a statute protect individuals from intentionally hurting other people. Negligence sometimes, yeah, mostly in the vaccine, but not intentional torts, intentional hurting, fraud. So we still have that, but, you know, we haven't seen any cases like that that succeeded either. So, and now just to touch upon the individual liberty interest again, just for a minute, this is what the state statutes, well, let's assume there's even going to be these fights, because if this sticks, if this OSHA mandate sticks, we have the risk of preemption. We also, so you know, some of the state protections are going to be possibly eliminated, but we still have the various mandates in the state and local level that do not relate directly to the OSHA mandate. In other words, smaller businesses, mom and pop shops, school vaccinations, those are all going to be probably state and local mandates. Some have already come down, like in California. I don't know if they're effective yet, but they're saying as small as, you know, five-year-olds being vaccinated without their consent, basically to stay in school. So, I mean, is it consent? I would say no. I happen to have done a study on the meaning of consent for my sex torts book that's still in the process because I stopped and wrote two books in the meantime on the Epstein and Weinstein scandals. But coercion is finally being recognized, and economic duress is finally being recognized as an exception to consent in the sexual context. That has never been done before. We're now seeing a shift in thought because it's now understood that what Weinstein did was he used economic coercion to the point where people really couldn't, they had to look the other way. Now, I'm not saying they did the right thing. I'm saying they were under so much financial pressure to look the other way they did. You know, and this is the kind of consent he got from the women. You know, they were threatened, they were coerced, they had no money. Cosby specifically commissioned a modeling agency in New York, a local agency, to send him the most desperate, poorest, most recently arrived models from around the world because he knew those were the ones that were easiest to influence and to push into sexual contact they didn't want. I mean, so my point is back to the consent. When you are saying to a, like this Hispanic mother in this not very wealthy community whose son was forced vaccinated without her consent, when you say to this lady who doesn't even speak English very well at all, either you vaccinate your son or you take him out of public school, does she really have a choice? Is she really going to be able to stay home and homeschool her child when she doesn't speak English and she needs to work just to pay her rent? The level of coercion is unprecedented and taking away people's jobs, their livelihood, they're losing their homes, they're losing their ability to send their kid to private school, all the things they're losing, their ability to live their lives. One of my dear friends in Malibu is a cancer researcher for 20 years with CEDARS, and she came from Argentina to be a cancer researcher here in America, and she has just lost her job, and she's been fired for not getting the vaccine. And so the coercion is very high. It's not a $5 fine, as in Jacobson. It's destroying people's lives. But the liberty interest for me is so serious because medical liberty is what I'm calling it. In my new article, I took the subset of privacy cases involving medical procedures, such as Roe versus Wade, and I took the subset of bodily integrity cases involving medical procedures, such as Rochin versus California, where they force-pumped a man's stomach to try to obtain evidence of his crime, and Winston v. Lee, where they wanted an order to get a bullet out of someone's shoulder to prove he was at the crime scene, and the court said no. The court has protected medical liberty, which is my new phrase calling these medical cases of liberty interest, at a very, very high degree, all to the point of, you know, allowing an elective procedure, an abortion, which, of course, is now under fire, too, which I disagree with. I think medical liberty should be fiercely protected by the court as it has been historically. But all of a sudden, we have this vaccine jurisprudence, which is a huge departure from the normal medical liberty cases where medical liberty is protected at a very, very high level, often given strict scrutiny or something like it, given some kind of heightened scrutiny. In Cruzan, the case where a lady was in a coma and her parents wanted to terminate life support, and the issue was actually not, it was an unusual issue. The issue is whether the state requiring proof of the comatose person's desire to be taken off, feeding tubes, they had to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. And the court upheld that, saying, look, a mistake is someone's end of their life. They didn't articulate a standard of review, but they hinted at something they said in Batsworth back in 1890, that you have unfettered discretion to reject unwanted medical treatment if you're, because you can, they're called the right to die case. So, again, the vaccines are this huge departure from this idea that you have complete medical autonomy over your body. And it's so disturbing to me because of the dangers of this vaccine. People are choosing not to get vaccinated, not to be obnoxious or selfish. They're afraid of dying, or they're afraid of getting sick or changing their DNA forever in a way that they may not like. How do we know this change to your DNA by the COVID-19 vaccine won't prove to be detrimental when a very different type of virus or fungal infection goes around? Because if you look at the CDC website, which I have to do my research, they said point blank, every single time we create a medicine or vaccine to combat some natural force of nature to keep the human population down, nature responds. And we can't outrun nature's way of keeping a balance on the earth. And that they didn't say it that way. I'm saying it this way. But I'm saying they have said that every single time we create a medicine or vaccine, nature changes, as you would expect. So we're trying to outrun nature here, and now we're forcing this vaccine on people that is specific to the original spike protein in the original COVID-19, and that's not even what's going around right now. So none of it makes sense. It's very, very disturbing.
Do you think there's any chance any of these lawsuits, including in Europe, are going to make a difference or be in time? It seems to me they may all prove to be too little too late.
Well, this is something I've talked about with a lot of my colleagues, including Reiner Fulmick and my husband to a large degree, and Alfred Brophy, one of my best friends from the Legal Academy, who's a professor for about 30 years. And what we're thinking is, if we're taking a huge step back from all of this and saying to ourselves, what's really going on here? And I can't believe, I will not believe, that our U.S. Supreme Court will allow people to be vaccinated, or lose their lives, lose their livelihoods, lose their ability to go to school and all that, with this vaccine and this disease. It's so far off base. But why is it taking so long? And this is a really interesting question. Why hasn't someone brought a lawsuit in California against the school vaccine mandates requiring COVID-19 vaccine for children as young as 5? Why wasn't there a swift, unconstitutional finding? Well, I can't answer that for sure. I can say a lot of the pleadings have been mishandled horribly, and I've been very active in writing to the lawyers involved and saying, look, your claim is going to fail as pled, and I explain why. Because they need constitutional scholars on these lawsuits, and they don't have them. They have people who are really into the cause, but you can't just be into the cause. You can't go running with a sword against machine guns. You've got to have the machine guns, and in this case, the machine guns are your constitutional scholars and your certified appellate lawyers, because I've seen how the courts are working, and the government attorneys have all the weapons in the world. They have tons of resources, tons of money, and they know the legal system inside and out. They know constitutional doctrine inside and out, and they're running over the plaintiff's lawyers. So that's part of the problem, is that the lawsuits being brought are not being brought by the kinds of lawyers who should be bringing these cases. And unfortunately, I think I'm the only law professor who's been on the record saying this is unconstitutional. So I'm not going to be bringing, for whatever reason, the entire legal academy is, what's a very democratic academy, and more importantly, if you speak out the way I have, I think you're at risk, just like the doctors are at risk who are issuing exemptions. And some of them are losing their licenses to practice medicine because they're issuing medical exemptions. So we're talking about this saying, well, what's going on? Part of it's a failure of the lawyers on our side of this to bring lawsuits that can win. And I keep honing in on this hybrid rights doctrine. They're bringing these religious freedom claims, which are losers. Religious freedom claims are losers since 1990 in the case called Employment Division versus Smith, when the court wiped out strict scrutiny as a standard and said, well, if it's a law of general applicability, we're basically going to defer. You can't say, well, my religion allows me to, you know, take heroin. Okay, that's not going to work. This is peyote in this case, but it makes sense what the court said in relation to that case. Although I disagree. The Native Americans used peyote for a long time. They should be allowed to do that. That's my opinion. But the bottom line is anyone who brings a religious freedom claim against a state or local mandate in today's world is being extremely foolish when the mandate involves a medical procedure, because that automatically triggers a liberty clause, a substantive due process challenge to the medical procedure itself. And to bring a freestanding religious freedom claim after Smith is mind-boggling to me. I actually asked Reiner on my show, my new Revolution Radio show called Legal Talk with Dina Sachs, every Saturday at 6 p.m. New York time. I asked him, are they trying to lose, Reiner? And he said, I hope not. So there's that. There's a problem with the litigation not being effective litigation, in my opinion. But there's still this overriding thing. And what are they really trying to do? So do I think the Supreme Court at some point will issue an opinion favorable to the individual? I do. Why is it taking so long? I don't know. It could be something like they want to get a very high vaccination rate before they say you can't do this, so that, well, if they believe it works, maybe they're trying to safeguard people. I don't believe it's that at all. I believe at this point it may be something like they don't want a clear control group. You know, if 50% are vaccinated and 50% are unvaccinated, it's harder to show that the vaccine caused various ailments and diseases down the road because, it's easier to show that if it's 50-50. If you get up to an 80%, 90% vaccination rate, now how can you really prove statistically as easily that the vaccines are the cause of various types of diseases that will come about later? You see, because you're losing the control group, the number of people unvaccinated is shrinking all the time. So I'm wondering, is it possible they want to? I don't know what's happening. And this is all speculation on my part and my colleague's part. We're just trying to understand what is happening, because to us, this is so clearly unconstitutional. And I'm at odds with my dear colleague and dear friend Erwin Chemerinsky on this, and it breaks my heart because we are normally, you know, directly, you know, we've always been on the same page. And suddenly we're at odds here because he says we are differing about the efficacy of the vaccine, and I think we're differing on politics at this point, which is a shame.
I want you to address the politics of the pandemic. I want you to go into that as much as you can. How do you see it?
Well, what I see is a takeover by one party of, you know, our entire government and our even private industry in terms of being able to tell us what we can do on a very personal level. I mean, this is so far beyond a political party gaining power. It's a political party in power issuing unprecedented mandates. Watching that some of the courts just really, you know, dance around the standards and make findings that are derived from the same entity that is violating our rights. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, what you normally do is look at both sides of an issue and look at both sides of the medical research, and that's not being done. They're just ignoring, and some of the people coming out against these mRNA vaccines and discussing the lack of efficacy and the dangers involved, these are people who were involved in the original research from the vaccines. A Nobel laureate is involved. I mean, these are people who are not some fly-by-night, you know, outliers. These are really respected scientists. And I sent you last night, I don't know if you saw it, this email that I found in an article I think it was last night I actually came across it, and it's an email written by an NIH person and sent to, I'm going to pull this up really quick, I don't know if you saw it. It's written by this guy, Francis Collins, October 8th, 2020, to Anthony Fauci, and he says, "Hi, Tony and Cliff. The proposal from the three fringe epidemiologists who met with the secretary seems to be getting a lot of attention. He's talking about press attention here. And even a co-signature from Nobel Prize winner Mike Levitt at Stanford. There needs to be a quick and devastating published takedown of its premise. I don't see anything like that online yet. Is it underway, Francis? So this is an open and obvious message saying to Fauci and others, let's take down and dismantle and discredit these scientists whose findings are contrary to what we want. And this is our government saying this. Instead of saying, hey, you know what we should be saying is, hey, there's some really prestigious scientists here who are saying that our information is not accurate. Shouldn't we launch a full investigation? No, not what he did. He wants to snowplow over them, discredit them, you know, and they people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been taken off social media. Why? They're accusing him of misinformation. I have personally seen some of the studies he's relying on. I was given some of those studies as part of my work with some of his people. He's not lying about anything, not in relation to this, not that I've ever seen. And it's really offensive to me that they're trying to discredit the people who are trying to bring light to this issue, humiliating them, embarrassing them, calling them pseudoscientists, fringe scientists, when these are the honest people. It's scary.
Gina, it's anything but following the science. It's politicizing the science and attacking the real scientists or exposing the truth. It's as disgusting as anything I've ever seen in terms of governmental action.
Same here. And especially as a constitutional scholar for over 20 years, I can't believe this isn't a slam dunk. I mean, looking at the research, even if we're not sure. Like, for example, in the case called Winston versus Lee, the police wanted an order to dig a bullet out of the suspect's shoulder because, of course, the bullet would show the forensics and they would be able to prove that he was at the scene. Well, he didn't want the bullet taken out, and for probably obvious reasons. He probably was there, right? But it was his body. And the court said, you know, we can't order this because when you dig and get a bullet out of someone's shoulder, there are unknown risks. You're digging through tissue. Who knows what could happen? He could get injured. And we're talking about digging a bullet out, which frankly I think is a lot. If I had to choose between having someone dig a bullet out of me versus taking that vaccine, I'll take digging the bullet out of me any day. Okay? But the court said we can't do that because there are unknown risks with digging the bullet out of his shoulder. Unknown risks. And I honed in on that when I read that case saying, yeah, if we don't know the risks involved, it's an oppressive thing to require our people to undergo a medical procedure and look at the risks that we already know about from the COVID-19 vaccine. Look at the unknown risks that they're going to manifest in the next 2 to 5 years. I would be shocked if in the next 2 to 5 years we don't see unusual cancers or unusual diseases that we've never seen before. This is experimental. Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen down the road. And that alone, the unknown risks alone, to me, are a reason to say people have to have a choice over their bodies.
Yes. Dina, this has been absolutely fabulous, just what I expected. I would like you to just take a few minutes to sum up what Americans need to understand here, just in as concise a fashion as you can, because I think the audience has been absolutely glued to every word you've had to say today.
Okay, well, I'm gonna address a few things one step at a time. Most of the questions I get are, what do I do? How can I avoid this? So the first thing you want to do as a person who's being subjected to a mandate and you don't want to get the vaccine is you do want to seek a religious exemption if possible. I mean, they're slamming them down. They're not being allowed in a lot of places. But there's some specific cases that have come out about the religious exemptions. And if they don't, if they don't go directly in line with the way exemptions have to go to get the sort of deferential review, then strict scrutiny applies. And that happened in the case in Arizona with some nursing students. I'm going to be going over this on my talk show down the road. So there's a way to get strict scrutiny with these exemptions being denied, which is what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act did, but it was struck down as to state and local governments. But that would bring it back up to the strict scrutiny that was created by Congress with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And by the way, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act still applies to federal mandates. So you still have that strict scrutiny involved. The other thing is medical exemptions. Jacobson said medical exemptions must be allowed when a person is known to be at high risk from vaccine. So that's the Supreme Court's original pronouncement in Jacobson. They said it would be cruel, you know, very cruel to force someone to be vaccinated if they have a condition that would indicate vaccine is not healthy for them. So it's another route to try is a medical exemption. And what if both don't work? What do you do? Well, maybe seek from your employer to work at home if it's possible, because the OSHA standard did say something about people who are completely working remotely don't need to necessarily comply with these standards. The next thing you can do is file a lawsuit, but I would say get a lawyer who understands constitutional law, especially if you're in the Ninth Circuit or the Tenth Circuit, or really any circuit, but the Ninth and Tenth have specifically embraced the hybrid rights doctrine. And let me explain this doctrine very quickly. If you have two or more constitutional rights being infringed, and one of them is religious freedom, you have a heightened review of the law involved. Because it's not just one, you know, one right being infringed, it's several. And so that normally would trigger heightened scrutiny. And the reason why is because when a law violates numerous constitutional provisions, that is kind of suspect. You have to say, well, wait a minute. This law is violating, you know, four different constitutional provisions. So you want to find a lawyer and possibly challenge it. But realistically, you're not going to have a job in the interim. This is my friend in Malibu, the cancer researcher. She didn't have a job. What's she going to do? So I think we all need to take a huge, you know, kind of spiritual step back and say, am I going to succumb or am I going to resist? And if I resist, what do I do? Well, I would start talking to other people, getting in chat rooms, find out where opportunities lie, move to Texas. I mean, it's a serious thing to move to a state. And by the way, we don't know what's going to happen with Governor Abbott's decisions now and his orders on protecting people from the COVID vaccine, because that's, like I said, being hinted at. So that's the next layer is move. Get out of there. Get into a state that you're going to be protected. Go to an employer that won't require the man, a smaller employer. But you also have to, at some point, have some faith and let go of a job where you may need that money. So you have to look into yourself. What can you do to create income for yourself? Lots of people are opening up their own businesses right now. Lots of businesses are being formed because they're being forced out of their industry. So, but that's tough. You almost have to have a profession, because without a profession, you don't have the skills to actually garner, you know, clientele. So, I mean, and then people are banding together. You know, they're moving in together. They're trying to share expenses. They're trying to find a way to lessen, you know, their monthly nut to be able to work part-time or find work and be able to survive without getting the mandate and not having a job. Rely on family members, rely on friends. Until this blows over, if it ever does blow over, we need to be resourceful as a people. But I would say resist. We have to resist. If we don't resist this, it will take over. And what's next? What if the state decides, you know, they want you to have a certain medication or a certain vitamin, or even worse, what if they, I mean, I'm conjuring up images of Nazi Germany right now about some of the things they did to experiment on human beings because they could. This opens the door to the government being able to tell us what to do to our bodies. And that to me is more frightening than anything. And I've said repeatedly for over a year now, there are some things worth dying for. There are some causes. I don't want to live in a country where I don't have control over my own body. I take my body very seriously. I don't know if you know, Jim, but I'm a dedicated, you know, exerciser. I'm into surfing, swimming, running, climbing. I mean, I take that as part of my commitment to myself, and because I do believe the body is a temple. I do believe you have an obligation to take care of yourself. All these years and decades of putting so much time into health, and all of a sudden someone can tell me, well, we decide we know what's better than you know. Even though I'm in perfect health at an advanced age, they're telling me now all of a sudden you have to take a vaccine. I'm like, I don't want a vaccine. So I didn't want to live in this country. This is what it's going to be like, but where do you go? It's happening all over Europe. It's even worse in Europe. So I would say, again, seek an exemption first. Second, consider a lawsuit. Third, you know, do an inventory of your skills. Can you start a business? Can you find a business that will hire you without the vaccine? But, you know, it's going to take some soul searching, and it's going to take being strong and having some faith that something will come up if you resist. Because if we don't resist, we are in big, big trouble.
Oh, Dean, I agree. I agree. As I see it, the government is, in essence, authorizing the mass murder of Americans using a lethal weapon that is being disguised as a medicine when it's anything but, and that Anthony Fauci will go down in history as the greatest mass murderer of the world that we have ever seen. That seems to me to be the bottom line.
I mean, these people are, I mean, I don't use the word evil very often because it sounds too biblical for me, but I do believe Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates are truly evil people. Bill Gates' relationship with Jeffrey Epstein is creepy to me. They were both against humanism. Epstein and Bill Gates after Epstein.
Gina, this was sensational. I can't thank you enough. You are fabulous. Thank you. Super.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict.